Coming up.
I'm not qualified to debate the science over climate change.
I'm not a scientist, nor am I a physicist.
I'm not a scientist.
Yes, everyone who denies man-made climate change has the same stirring message. We don't know what the f*** we're talking about.
People like to pretend that science is value neutral, but isn't science infused with values?
Think about, of all the data that's out there, how much of it becomes available to you consciously. That's a filtering process that's driven by your education, your attention, your training, and all of that can be influenced by your political background.
Shouldn't politics just be kept out of science?
It's good to want objectivity, and I think you can still have it.
Our guest is Sharon Clough from Oregon State University.
The best way to be objective is not to try and get rid of politics, because I think that's important, but to make sure that the politics influencing your science is relevant and well supported by evidence.
Science and politics, friends or foes?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the campus of Oregon State University in Corvallis, where they stomp the ducks.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner down south at Stanford University. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today, we're thinking about science and politics. We're asking, are they friends or are they foes?
Well, there's a clear answer. It depends on where the money is.
Oh, come on, John. That's so cynical sounding.
Ah, come on. I'm serious. Ever meet a politician who was against a scientific project and thought it was an expensive boondoggle when it was going to be funded in their district? No, then it's really great science. The space station, the superconducting super collider.
Well, I can't say I've met anybody. You've got a point there. Okay.
And how many politicians turn a blind eye to scientific truth, on the other hand, in exchange for a few bucks from the likes of the tobacco lobby or the climate change deniers or the creationists?
Way too many. What's your point?
Nothing ever good comes from the intrusion of politics into science. We should keep the politics out of science and the science out of politics.
Nah, you can't possibly. That's too simple-minded, John. You can't possibly keep politics out of science. Come on, unless you're talking about ending all government funding of scientific research. An even worse idea is keeping science out of politics. We need scientists to speak truth to power, John.
Well, I think when science gets in bed with politics, science becomes politicized, and that's bad for science.
You're thinking about science like it was way back when, several hundred years ago. Some sort of pristine, value-free search for truth, forever walled off from politics, the larger society, and all that.
Yeah, well, it's good enough for Galileo. Why isn't it good enough for you?
Well, because contemporary science is too big, it's too expensive, and it's too high stakes to be walled off from politics. Well, come on, say you're the National Institutes for Health. You've got billions of dollars to hand out in research grants, but you've also got scads of scientifically worthy proposals to choose from among. You got proposals on cancer, you got the brain, on aging, on prenatal care. You can't fund them all. How do you decide?
Well, how about, say, deciding on the basis of scientific merit.
Yeah, but suppose they all have equal scientific merit. Suppose they're all groundbreaking stuff. That doesn't mean, though, that they're equally deserving of public funds. Look, deciding which things deserve to be funded, especially with public money, is inescapably a matter of values. And yes, John, that means politics.
You're using the term politics in a certain sense, so that any time public money is involved, any time there's a decision about public money, it's a matter of politics. So you've got a point in that sense. But when I say politics just distorts science, I mean something different. Take the debate over climate change. Now, why do some people insist on denying that changing human activity might help with global warming and it might have made a massive contribution to the problem in the first place? Why do they deny that in spite of the you know, really considerable, possibly overwhelming scientific consensus to the contrary.
Well, yeah, that's a question. I think the answer is they feel like their way of life is threatened, and they don't want to change.
But if you were to ask them straight up, they wouldn't say that. They'd try to argue science with you. They'd insist that what you take to be settled science isn't really settled at all.
Yeah, but they're just flapping their lips when they say that. Do you really think they truly, sincerely believe that stuff?
Well, I think they're utterly sincere.
No, come on. How could they be utterly sincere?
Because they're engaging in motivated cognition. They're letting their desires and political agendas determine how they assess the evidence and what they're willing to believe on the basis of that evidence. Now, that's not a good thing. That's an irrational thing.
I've got no brief for climate change deniers, so you got a point. But I got to say, we all engage in what you call motivated cognition all the time, don't we?
I certainly hope not.
Come on. Suppose you know, unbeknownst to me, that my most trusted friend has robbed a bank. And you're going to tell me about it. I wouldn't want to believe you. I wouldn't want to believe it for a second. And just because I wouldn't want to believe you, I'd subject any evidence that you offered to me. No, you didn't really see him. He couldn't have been there. I'd subject it to intense scrutiny. Now, that's all the climate change deniers are doing. And, you know, I have to admit, it seems perfectly human.
Perfectly human, but not perfectly rational. When you start thinking that way, you're going to end up like the battered wife who's desperate to keep her marriage intact and refuses to believe the overwhelming evidence that her husband isn't going to change. We in California, we think, well, the jet stream, it's going to come to its senses. You know, just give it a little time. It doesn't realize how much it's hurting us.
Yeah, you know, okay, look. Anything can be taken to extremes. I grant you that. But I still say you're living in a fantasy. There's no way, no way whatsoever, you can just totally shield your beliefs from being affected by your interests. Cognition is necessarily motivated in the way you want to dismiss.
Well, I don't know. I think that's what the scientific method is all about. Unbiased, dispassionate, disinterested search for truth. Not in it turning out one way or another, but in learning what the truth is, whatever it turns out to be.
Haven't you read your Nietzsche? I don't agree with you that we're interested in the truth, whatever it is. Some truths just aren't worth knowing. Only truths that serve our genuine interest are even worth pursuing. So the interests shape everything.
Nietzsche. Well, Nietzsche's theorem, something about chemistry. Then why should I care what this lunatic German said about science? I'm not convinced, not at all. But I guess we need some more food for thought. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, out to explore how political intervention in science can actually be life-saving, especially for women. She files this report.
In the late 1950s, engineers created the crash test dummy. It was a brilliant idea, and it helped save a lot of lives.
These scientifically advanced lifelike dummies are helping General Motors lead the industry in safety-related research by demonstrating how the human body withstands force.
The crash test dummy was modeled after the height, weight, and proportions of an average white male. But that's not too helpful for a pregnant female.
We have had crash test dummies, you know, to test for car safety for many, many years, but no one really thought about the impact of the seatbelt on the pregnant belly.
That's Londa Schiebinger from Stanford. She's director of a program called Gendered Innovations in Science, Medicine, and Engineering.
The seatbelt is supposed to stay low and flat across your waist, but when you're pregnant, it doesn't stay down there. It just creeps up. And then if you're in a small car accident, that belt is going to press in on the pregnant belly and damage the fetus.
Car companies didn't think to make a pregnant dummy until the early 2000s. Even though a woman's chances of getting into a car accident goes up by 42% in her second trimester. Schiebinger says a lot of people lobbied to get a female crash test dummy. It was political action that created that change in engineering. Politics can also be helpful in medicine. Consider drug testing. Before a drug is available to the public, it goes through different phases of testing. The problem is, these clinical trials used to be done exclusively on men. That led to a lot more women getting severe side effects from new treatments. People like Schiebinger lobbied to change that.
A lot of people think of science as a self-correcting system, But often when it comes to gender or ethnicity, you know, it isn't self-correcting. It took a law. It took, you know, Congress had to pass a law to insist that women be included in clinical trials, and expense couldn't be an excuse.
Before new drugs are tested on humans, they're often tested on small animals, like mice. Now get this, those mice have almost always been male too. But why?
Because there's the pesky hormones. The women have cycles, and little rats have four-day cycles. Oh my goodness. So in order to keep things constant, the idea is that you use males. Okay, well, that doesn't really work, does it? Because we release drugs to the human population, of which 50% is having hormonal cycles.
It took until May 2014 before medical studies included female lab animals and female cells and tissues in clinical trials. Schiebinger says it wouldn't have happened without political action. She says the idea that science and politics don't mix is simply naive, because science is political at its very core.
Science depends on human decision making, and we have to realize that how we fund science and the priorities that we set for what we know determine to a certain extent what we know.
Politics is what got us a pregnant crash test dummy over 50 years after the first dummy was created. It's why we now include females and female rodents in medical testing. Schiebinger says there's always going to be good politics and bad politics in science. But like it or not, the two will always be bedfellows. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher from Stanford, Ken Taylor. And we are coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis.
Our guest today is a professor of philosophy from right here at OSU. She's author of Beyond Epistemology, A Pragmatist Approach to Feminist Science Studies. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Sharon Clough. Welcome, Sharon.
So, Sharon.
So, John.
What first got you interested in the relationship between politics and science? Is there a crooked politician or a corrupt scientist in your family tree? Or?
No, I'm from Canada. We don't have any of that there.
Oh.
No, so I have to admit, John, I was a feminist before I was a philosopher. And I was a feminist, I thought, because there was excellent evidence, scientific evidence, some of it, in support of feminism. And then I come to philosophy and I discover, oh, no, feminism, that's a political value. And values aren't the sorts of things for which you can have evidence. Only facts have evidence. I just thought this was crazy. So here I am.
Well, now that we've got you here, you can settle things and then we can go out and drink. Who's right? Ken, or me, and Galileo, and Newton. That is to say, Ken thinks the search for knowledge is inescapably guided by interests and values, and I think science ought to be unbiased, dispassionate, disinterested pursuit of truth. So who's right? Who's got it right?
Ken's more right than you, I'm afraid, John. Yeah, no, I think he's got it right. It's good to want objectivity, recognizing it was actually great to have Londa Schiemager's voice in here just before this. She was saying that there's going to be politics in science all the time, some of it good, some of it bad. I'm going to suggest here that you can actually tell the difference sometimes, and the best way to be objective is not to try and get rid of politics, because I think that's important, but to make sure that the politics influencing your science is relevant and well supported by evidence. Yay!
The politics supported by evidence. Now, that's a little strange. I don't quite understand what that means. Politics are people with agendas, competing agendas for what is to be done, with competing values as to what matters. I mean, I say this matters more to me and that matters more to you. Now, we're to turn to the evidence to say who's got it right in terms of what matters. I don't quite understand how that works.
Okay, you're taking John's role here, Ken. Okay, well, so here's how it works, I think, and again, to use from Londa's example, the crash test dummy. So they talked about political lobbying that was required to get pregnant
crash test dummies included. Well, guess what? They didn't say the word, the F word, but it was feminists who were doing the political lobbying, and they used evidence of the numbers of crashes that women were in, and if we're really interested in reducing the kinds of harms that passengers have in cars, then which they all claim they do, then looking at the evidence of the role of pregnant women and how pregnant women were not being represented by crash test dummies up to this is bad science.
So it's like you endorse the point she made. It sounds like you're endorsing her point that science, the scientific method, is not self-correcting. You need this outside thing, politics, sometimes, to make science get on a better path. Are you endorsing a view like that?
Well, actually, I'm going to complicate it a little because I don't think that it's obvious what things are, that politics is a world where there's no scientific evidence, and then science is where the method happens, and they wear their lab coats, and that in fact, if we think of politics as being influenced by science and science being influenced by politics, then the line between them gets blurred appropriately. So the only kind of politics I want influencing science is politics that's well supported by evidence.
I mean, you can look at science as two ways. You can look at science as a big institution that we have that's, you know, got economics and so forth and so on, or is this really a practice governed by principle? And I guess we'll continue this.
Getting into big, deep territory, and we don't want to give it short shrift. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Oregon State University in Corvallis. Our guest is Sharon Clough, author of Beyond Epistemology.
What role do our interests and values play in shaping scientific inquiry? Do they merely distort our attempts to uncover the truth, or can they aid our search for truth?
Value laid in science and the pursuit of truth, along with questions from our value-laden audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Sharon Clough from Oregon State University. And we're thinking about science and politics, and we're asking whether they're friends or foes.
Do political values and considerations necessarily distort science? Or does paying attention to our values and interests improve science and make it easier to see the truth? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphones in front of the stage.
So, Sharon, you said I was more right than John. So it sounded a little bit like you want to have it both ways. You want to have John's objectivity, but you also want to acknowledge what we call motivated cognition, value-driven cognition. You seem to think it's sometimes good and sometimes bad, but I got to ask you, is there some way of distinguishing when we ought to let our interests and values guide inquiry and when we shouldn't? Because trying to have your cake and eat it, too, is a really hard thing to do.
Although I got to say, why would you want to have your cake if you can't eat it? Of course I want both of them. So it would go something like this. We're never going to be neutral. We are always going to be motivated, even as scientists. I mean, we put on our lab coats, but that doesn't, you know, it's not like they're made of some kind of motivational blocking material, right, the name of which escapes me. It's that, so we're going to always have motivations. We're never going to be neutral. Then what we have to do is practice and practice and practice at being impartial. So impartial means being prepared, first of all, to bring those motivations to make them more explicit. Because often they're working, you know, in the background. And that's where they can be dangerous. Make them more explicit. And then see what kinds of, first of all, are they relevant? They might not be. And if they are relevant, you're going to have to be prepared to test them. And if your motivations don't hold up to test, you're going to have to suck it up and give them up.
Yeah, I want to know more about this testing your motivations and values and stuff like that. Because I think of theories, hypotheses, and which are claims about the facts and what explain this. Those are the things we test. I mean, you might say testing out your values, like try this value and see how things go. But I don't think of values as like empirically testable. I mean, maybe I've got a backwards picture, but help enlighten me.
Well, that's kind of you. Let me enlighten you. Okay.
Yes, well, you're the guest,
well,
you know.
That's right. Well, I'm very much influenced by American pragmatism, and I think John Dewey would say, in fact, we do test out facts and see how living with those facts works. And similarly with our values. I learned about gravity as a kid, you know, by experiencing it in the world and seeing how my life worked with figuring out how gravity worked. Similarly with being a feminist, you know, the sexist crap I was getting, those messages seemed to be completely uninformed by the evidence of the experience of anyone around me, or what evidence I was told about was drawn from, you know, really bad samples, overgeneralizations. And so the feminist political values I started to pick up were ones that were better fit with the evidence of my experience. I had to get rid of some of them sometimes.
Yeah, but I mean, with all due respect, feminism has been around for quite a while now, and it's not exactly pristine in its approach to the world either. Take any university. I mean, you don't need to get Congress to get into politics. Any university, you've got different people competing for funds. You've got the entomology department and other biologists and the School of Medicine and so forth and so on, and feminist studies is just part of it. Doesn't politics saturate all academia, scientific, humanistic, and feminist studies as well?
Oh, sure. I've been focusing on feminist political values just because that's my own area of research, but there's all kinds of influences we might have. Politics concerning, you know, ethnic political commitments or relative to your ethnicity or your concerns about racism, or when we think politics in the U.S., of course, we might think about, you know, political parties like Democrat or Republican, and those are all in the mix.
Let me put the question a little more edgy. Okay, suppose I'm a white supremacist.
Yeah.
And I'm studying race and eugenics and all that sort of stuff. Then my science is going to look a certain way.
It's going to be bad science, Ken.
Wait, let me finish. I'm trying to be neutral. My science is going to look a certain way. Suppose I'm a feminist. Then my science is going to look a different way. Suppose I'm some kind of egalitarian about everybody, you know, the cultural melting pot, and my science is going to look. Now, why would any particular science have a better claim, in virtue of the values it embodies, to be better science than some other science? Right. I mean, that's what gets the neutrality and dispassionate and all that sort of stuff. Science is supposed to be accessible. Scientific truth is supposed to be accessible independently of your standpoint, independently of your point of view. That's the point of objectivity. So, but it seems radically in some kind of tension with this sort of value distance.
Sure, it is definitely in tension. I think here's where it's just going to be really important to get down to specifics. We can talk about, you know, a white supremacist. Well, what are the particular white supremacist values that you have? How are those making themselves felt in a particular scientific setting? It might be that if you're doing a certain kind of, you know, astrophysics, it might make no difference at all. So relevance becomes really important here. I have a couple of examples of course, they're feminist examples.
Give me one good one.
Yeah, okay, one good one. All right. So Elizabeth Anderson, she's this great philosopher, University of Michigan. She has this great paper where she talks about feminists doing social science on the effects of divorce on women. And she claims, and I think she's right, that when the feminists, they have a cape, were doing social science research on divorce, they were getting it way better as a result of their feminist politics than the previous research in two ways. The first was that previous more sexist research, more traditional research on divorce, on the effects of divorce on women, had gathered subjects for their studies exclusively from women who were seeking therapy because they were completely, you know, devastated by the divorce. And all of their surveys, the questions that you would ask, were all about, you know, how terrible is your divorce?
Right.
So these feminist researchers, in contrast, got a more representative sample drew from women from broader contexts, and they had surveys that were more open and allowed for women to actually say occasionally, you know, the divorce, it was crappy while I was going through it, but it was the best thing to ever happen to me. Yeah, so their feminist politics drove them to a much empirically stronger research program.
So I want to get a better sense of where things come in. So in the example from Shuka, we had the experiments were kind of wrong. And is it always the experiments? Sometimes, like in economics, you see values affect the theory. They have idealizations that make no sense unless you have kind of an Ayn Randian perspective on values. It's true. Do people who are doing the work you do you have kind of a theory about the different places in which feminist values should come into the scientific enterprise?
Do we have a theory? Are you kidding me? Of course we have theories, but I'll avoid them. Let me. There's numerous ways you can talk about the different levels. So think about of all the data that's out there, how much of it becomes available to you consciously. That's a filtering process that's driven by your education, your attention, your training, and all of that can be influenced by your political background. Then think about of the data that's available to your conscious awareness, which data you decide to pay attention to as support for a hypothesis. That's a whole other level of decision making. And then how you frame the evidence for that hypothesis, the framing of it, just like we're doing here, framing our conversation, that takes all kinds of decision making that involves background assumptions that might you might not be paying attention to. And then deciding when to stop gathering evidence.
Right. That's so it comes
really
in
crucial.
Everywhere it might come in.
Yeah.
Is kind of the thing.
Everywhere
you're
all the time.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're in front of a live audience at the Oregon State University in Corvallis, and we've got questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
My name's Evan. I'm from Corvallis. I'm a nuclear engineer, and in my field, we have lots of cases where you have widespread fear and it might outweigh scientific fact. And my question is, how can you have lawmakers possibly making effective policies in, say, the nuclear industry without, you know, hard science to combat popular disapproval?
Sure, you absolutely need your politics to be informed by the best science, and you need your science to be informed by the best politics.
You're reacting to John said in the beginning, get science out of politics. I don't think he really meant that, because you really do need you really do need scientists to speak truth to power.
As a nuclear scientist, you have something particular in mind, like this thing that's been going on forever about storing nuclear waste in Nevada. Some people say it's all set up and we're just not doing it and that's stupid, but the politicians in Nevada don't want it to happen. Is that an example of the kind of thing you have in mind?
Yeah, sort of. Like, you have Nevadans and they don't want the nuclear waste in their backyard, and that's totally respectable. But, you know, sometimes it's just you have cases where we don't want this thing and we can't really explain why. It's personal and values-based rejection when the science says otherwise and we can contain things.
Right. We need scientists to speak truth to everybody, to the public, to power. It's not something you can settle once and for all just by thinking about it.
Right.
The proof is actually in the pudding, right? I scientific paradigms and ways of framing issues and ways of assessing evidence have to compete to earn their keep. And so if there's a feminist value in few science and they're not, you have to see what's delivered.
That's right.
There's no guarantee a priori that...
Right.
Infuse this inquiry with those values and you're going to necessarily get truth. I mean, if you could know that, it would be a lot easier.
Ooh, I should say, though, try this out. Like, I'm a fan of induction. So if, for example, we have study after study after study trying to find out the biological reasons for why women are stupid, let's just say. And at some
but
point...
Women aren't stupid.
Well, at some point, we keep... You know, having to correct that science, and it's just, look, this is the wrong kind of question to ask. It's based, you know, a ton of ridiculous sexist assumptions are underlying it. At some point, I would want to say, maybe a priori, not a priori,
based on the extended induction.
Yeah.
But that's not a priori.
No,
that's
extent.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
My name is Bob. I'm from Corvallis, and my question has to do with the role of time in this discussion. The amount of time it takes to get it right for a culture to do away with its bias, and the scientific tools is what takes us there. And you look at things like the Earth is the center of the universe or the Earth is round, look how long that took versus plate tectonics. So I guess I'd ask, what role does time play, or is time, the shortness of the time, an indicator of the enlightenment of a society?
There's also the issue of the importance of doing something rapidly. I mean, I've sat through lots of appeals by physicists and astrophysicists who I think they're great, their science is great, but sometimes it's a little hard to see why it matters whether we know these facts about the beginning of the Big Bang in 5 years or 50 years or 500 years or ever, right? I mean, scientists like to push the value of truth and the thrill of humans knowing the truth and the great pride we feel when we find that we can discover all sorts of things about the universe that we might have never guessed we would have discovered. But other values have to come in, too. I mean, like, what's the harm if no one discovers the truth about this for another 600 years as opposed to curing Ebola or something like that?
Well, I have a slightly different take on your question. So tell me, I should say that The NSF, for example, is famously and increasingly rewarding experimental trials with shorter and shorter turnaround times. So the kinds of longitudinal studies that we need for answering more complex questions, especially about human behavior, are not being incentivized financially any longer. And I think that's a problem. And I think that the kind of making explicit the value commitments that we have requires thinking more carefully about the hypotheses as we set them up. It requires thinking more carefully about designing the experiment. It involves thinking more carefully about when we're going to end the experiment, how we write our discussions that then go into the media. It involves talking with folks who have all kinds of different political backgrounds that to help bring you up to speed on stuff that may or may not be relevant. None of that is currently well rewarded in our scientific funding, and that's an issue of time, and I think that's a problem.
Yeah, science as a public undertaking is obviously infused with lots of pressures, competing pressures. Right? When we do this collective, when we set up a government that does this, right, and that government's answerable to us, and I mean, so yeah, certain things will be more urgent and all that stuff, and funding models will be all kinds of pressured by politics. That's science embedded in a social context. Science is a pure form of inquiry, though, which John was kind of dissing. I think it's a really cool thing. I mean, if it didn't take resources, and if you could just think forever about how the universe started, I can't think of a cooler question.
Well, that's when you become a philosopher.
Well, that's like, yeah, but there's a kind of free inquiry part of
it. I wasn't dissing it. I was just saying, you know, there's the value of the truth, and there's the urgency of particular
right,
truths.
No, I agree. But those are questions about science in this society and what we want it for and what it's obviously. I'm going to take one last question before the break. Welcome to Philosophy Talk Now.
Hi, I'm Gretchen from Minnesota, and my question is whether or not we need to democratize science even more. I think science is very top, filters down to the bottom in a very interesting power hierarchy, and so maybe one of the answers to this question, you know, the NSF, all these big agencies have so much control, but is there a way we should democratize science to improve it? Thank you.
Well, the democratization question is a big one in my field of research on this question. One way to think about it is, well, the more different kinds of people get involved in science, the more likely we are to have people with different biases and different values at play, and we're always better at seeing the biases and values in other people than in ourselves. That's got to be right. But I would want something.
That's a priori.
Yeah. Well, that's lots of experience. Yeah. So I'd want to be a little more radical than that, though, and suggest that we have some evidence that bringing in certain kinds of values is more likely to be. So democratizing with an agenda is what I would want.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about science and politics with Sharon Clough, author of Beyond Epistemology.
In our final segment, we'll take up the training of scientists. If it's true that science can never be value neutral, how do we ensure that scientists that have only the right values shape the questions they ask and the evidence they consider?
We're coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis. We'll take more questions from our live and lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Sharon Clough from Oregon State University. And we're thinking about science and politics. We're asking, are they friends or foes? And we've got a question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I'm Attila. I'm from Seattle. As a physics major, often it comes down to the funding to fund these large experiments done in the physics community. So my question is, how can we maybe energize politics to apply more funding and maybe have a better outreach to show the importance of why we need these big physics experiments being done?
So what you're thinking of, the super collider and things like that?
Yes.
That costs billions, right?
Yes.
And who cares? I mean, why is it important?
Well, of course, you know, as many philosophers, we love to know about the grand scheme of the universe and how it all started and the true nature behind it. So
I know, but why should the average taxpayer who's going to fund this put a lot of value on us figuring out the basic scheme of the universe, as opposed to leaving it to people to figure out after we've maybe figured out war, peace, Ebola, and disease. I mean, you and your friends in physics, I have great admiration for you, but you're expensive.
Well, look, here to help him out, I mean, there are questions of priorities that it would be really cool if we had a country that funded, I hate to use the word pure physics, you know, but I think that pure applied distinction is problematic for ways you can imagine. But the amount we spend on wars and funding of arms for not wars we're involved in, but tons of other wars that other people are involved in, I mean, it'd be really cool if we reprioritize things, and I wouldn't mind throwing a few bucks his way.
No, I wouldn't mind throwing a few bucks his way either, but I do think there's a deep issue here. Because, look, once again, it goes back to the things we were saying in the last segment. Once this is a public undertaking in a democracy and there are all these competing values, pure scientific curiosity is going to lose out to lots and lots of considerations. And I think we're interested in the superconducting supercollider out of pure scientific curiosity, mainly, not because it's going to... I mean, if it were going to help us build better atom bombs, the government would, you know, the quantum bomb, the government would invest zillions of dollars in it, right? But pure scientific curiosity is going to lose out. Now, if you want your science to be pristine, don't subject it to public... public funding like that.
But recognize your science is never going to be pristine and that there are some values driving it and try to show that those values are worth holding. Make a case for that. And also, I think we need to recognize that it's not always obvious how a particular scientific inquiry is going to have, you know, or what outcomes it's going to have down the road.
But Sharon, your argument, you know, you got to admit it's lame. You can't argue.
No.
You can't argue it's a bad idea to fund another Iraq war or even the one we already had. Therefore, it's a good idea to fund really expensive, money-intensive physics experiments.
I think I said I would throw a few bucks his way, John.
A few bucks will not...
It's not going to get us a super colliding superconductor.
Take the entire budget of all the philosophy departments in the U.S., call out a few bucks. You're not even going to get the land graded properly for the super collider.
Right.
Welcome to philosophy.
Hi, my name is Patricia. I'm from Portugal, and I have a question that comes a bit from a different perspective, and it's mainly from the perspective of politics. I think we use the idea of science and the purity of science as in it can transfer into politics and therefore purify politics and kind of make politics. It's very often the ideal type that we have about this. Don't you think that this is, again, the problem of talking about values and having such polarizing conversations in science and is value-free and value-laden, that we create this notion that we can purify politics and we can simply transfer the notion of scientific truth into a politics that is truthful as well without actually... transforming politics simultaneously, and while we also have this process going through the public sphere. So we have an opportunity for values in so many levels that it seems a bit baffling to me that why don't we have more this conversation about values? Why do you think values are so daunting?
Well, we haven't talked about this yet, but I think one of the main worries about values in science is because the concern, and actually I get this from Elizabeth Anderson as well, the concern is that values are the sorts of things that people hold dogmatically and that it's the kind of things we're less likely to put forward critical scrutiny. And I think two things. One is I think that's an empirical fact, but I think it's not unfixable, and I think it's going to have to be part of the training of scientists, first of all, to get them to recognize they have their values and that it's not a weakness to talk about them and to think about what, you know, evidence they have for them. And, going to university is all about, you know, ditching the values you came in with when you discover you've got no good evidence for them.
So you just said something. People hold their values dogmatically. And if you're going to be a scientist who allows values to shape inquiry, I should think you don't want to hold values dogmatically.
Right.
Moreover, you don't want to hold values necessarily, as it were, fixedly. That is, you want to be open to the possibility that you might have to abandon these values in this domain, bring other.
Right.
It's hard enough to teach people how to run experiments on mice, for crime's sakes. How do you teach them to run experiments on their values?
Well, first of all, you encourage them to become philosophy majors or minors, and that they should take classes in sociology of science and history of science and philosophy of science. This distinction between humanities and sciences has just got to go. We must be much better, well-rounded. Yay! Someone's going to clap for that. Yay!
Yay! This is philosophy talk.
That's right. And it's going to be an uphill slog, but that doesn't mean it's not worth doing.
I want to ask you about the feminist thing.
The feminist thing.
Because
Putting my cape back on.
The kind of point that you made and that Londa Schiemiger made in our roving report, it's very powerful. Mm-hmm. I do not deny it. Extraordinarily powerful stuff. There was scientific advancement. But I wonder about the possible undertow. Here's something over the years I've come to believe, that we have not, that scientists, social scientists, behavioral scientists, have not thought hard enough about the psychosocial development of boys. Mm-hmm. I mean, my attention to this comes from having raised a boy and mm-hmm. watched all the struggles that boys go through and all this stuff in the schools. The reigning ideology is that we have this patriarchy, that there's male privilege, that boys have this privilege, but many boys are getting crushed.
Right.
By the school system, right. There's this wonderful book on Raising Cain called Raising Cain, which talks about how boys don't even know how to name their emotions.
Right.
They're emotionally mute, and our society's so blind to that.
Right.
Some feminists, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, feminists feel that this focus on the psychosocial development of boys is deeply problematic, because it's like, oh, girls aren't the problem, boys are the, it's like
right.
shifting the focus.
Right.
So there's a...
Well, so here again, let's get specific about which feminist values we're going to talk about, because it's true. It's a big label. It captures a lot of things. Some things that count as feminist values, I wouldn't think, have a lot of evidence in support of them. So like the view that some folks would call feminist, that women are like really peaceful, and like if only women like ran the world or were in charge of the government, there wouldn't be like any more wars. And I just think that's a really bad feminist value.
Is that a Valley Girl
feminism?
You know
how it is. I know it is. But it's if we're going to call it a feminist value, I think it's one for which we have very little empirical evidence. Similarly, I would think that the kinds of feminist values I would want to support with respect to the concern you have about raising boys is, look, feminists are really interested in gender socialization and the tools we've brought to bear about the power of socialization to make people feel like their gender identity is absolutely a necessary thing as opposed to a cultural product. I mean, that's something that we can use to learn to understand masculine gender identity as well.
I was reluctant to use the word feminism because it's too broad of a brush. But I'm just talking about, look, focus on some kind of values can blind you to other values that are equally important, so that even though it advances you here, I mean, there could be a way of focusing newly on girls and their development that blinds you to the complexity of boy development, right? So even though it advanced you here, it cost you there. And so how do you negotiate these?
Well, just like you would negotiate any kinds of, balancing acts within basic factual, I don't think that it's a values versus values makes it any more difficult. We have to do these balancing acts in all kinds of areas.
Well, I mean, there's a view, my view, which is actually
oh no,
actually very coherent. I mean,
it's coherent. I'll be the judge of that,
well,
John.
If you were raised on a farm or near farms or worked on farms like I do, you think very much like this Valley feminist that you were making fun of. I mean, masculine, feminine, male, female is goes throughout the mammal world. And there are generalizations. You don't see a lot of fights between female goats. You can't have two billy goats in the same yard. The same. So I'm with your Valley Girl. I think males are. I'm not saying that if Margaret Thatcher ruled the world, it would be great. On the other hand, if we're going to have males be part of the group, then we have to spend a lot of time getting boys in touch with their emotions. Otherwise, it's just like asking the billy goats to come on into the pen.
I think there's not a feminist alive who wouldn't want more boys to be in touch with their emotions.
We're going to take one last question. Welcome to Philosophy Talks here.
Hi, I'm Ben. And my question was basically going back to feminism and the intermingling of politics and science. So being that science tries to be as unbiased as possible, whereas politics seems to be extremely biased, Where do you think you might be able to kind of draw the line in the sand where politics can step into science and say that you're being biased here and you need to draw it back, or should science be more pure than that?
Excellent question.
Oh, good. Well then. So it's going to depend on what the politics are and what the particular scientific study is. And some political questions are going to be irrelevant in some scientific contexts, but where they're relevant, they need to be the right politics. So I don't think there's going to be a, like Ken said earlier, a line in the sand that we can draw ahead of time. We're just going to have to be prepared for more complexity than we currently train our scientists to deal with.
I know we don't have any more time, but I think you believe in practical wisdom. You believe in Aristotelian practical wisdom.
I even run a lab called Phrenesis Lab for just that reason, Ken. Perfect.
Yes, yes. So, Sharon, this has been a great conversation.
Yay.
We've just touched the surface. I wish we could go on, but we can't because he's giving me the goodbye sign. So I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been awesome. Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Sharon Clough, a dynamic and amazing professor of philosophy here at Oregon State University, author of Beyond Epistemology, A Pragmatist Approach to Feminist Science Studies. So, John, what are your last thoughts here?
Well, you know, the most democratic institution we have as a result of our Constitution is the House of Representatives. So the most democratic thing you can think of is a member of the House of Representatives being head of the science committee and having a huge influence over science. And that fellow, I think a guy named Gumpert or something like that from Texas, just said that God wouldn't allow global warming. he doesn't seem to know about Noah.
So you still think politics and science is a dangerous bedfellow?
I still think there's a problem here.
Yeah, so I think you may be right, and there's a lot more to talk about, and this conversation will continue at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blago. I think, therefore I blog. You too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from a fast-talking frenemy. It's Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, like the rest of you, I have really important things to worry about in the 21st century, and I try to dedicate a small portion of my brow to furrowing once a week or so about the future of science, among other endangered human activities like family sing-alongs, reading, and common sense. I've been intrigued by the steady chip-chip-chip of young Earth creationism at evolution, for instance. It's not that evolution is really in danger. I mean, it is how nature works, after all. It's not going to stop working just because a creationist saw a monkey in the zoo and concluded, therefore, that Adam and Eve were as real as a dime. If we are descended from monkeys, demand creationists, why do we even still have them? Well, I don't know. For the same reason chihuahuas and coyotes coexist, I guess, though, of course, not in the same place. The trouble science has is you can't just stop creationists from going along on the research trip to the Amazon or the Grand Canyon, because then science will be accused of censoring their views, kind of the way now proponents of climate change are accused of Nazi tactics of suppression when they question the motives of climate change deniers. On the other hand, the state of Florida, and I just read Wisconsin as well, have banned government workers from saying or writing the words climate change, which by their rights, I guess, is not suppression, but just plain common sense, which, as I said before, is an endangered human activity. We should be grateful. But even on the side of supposed supporters of evolution, do we really understand what evolution is? I've heard people described as being evolved, meaning that they recycle. Listen to their mate. I mean, really listen. Drive a hybrid, avoid red meat and gluten, do yoga, are conscious, mindful, and never leave snarky comments on Gawker. But I hate to break it to you, old hippie America, being nice is not the same thing as being evolved. It can be, if you're in an environment like Portland, say, or the old San Francisco before the tech bros moved in. A vegan flautist who has learned to deny his white male privilege might indeed be the big frog in that puddle. But in the larger world, where bombing Iran seems to be a widely accepted template for a visionary foreign policy, the evolved person would probably be a meat-eating warrior type with flinty eyes and lethal combat skills. On the other hand, this person might conceivably wind up dead in the ensuing war, diminishing the gene pool. Therefore, so much for evolution. The point is, we often use scientific terms without fully understanding them. If you don't like chocolate, for example, you might describe yourself as hardwired that way. You're hardwired not to like football or to resent Obama or to prefer driving to riding a bus. Well, no, that's bad science. You're not a robot, so you're not hardwired. You're just another idiot with strong opinions. We have no shortage of those. I'm living proof. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Bill Ugalas, Dewani Howard, and the OSU School of History, Philosophy, and Religion, the Associated Students of Oregon State University, and the staff of the Withicum Theater.
Thanks also to Joel Groves and Liz Steiner.
The program is produced by the one and only Devin Strolovich. The brilliant Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is the smooth and suave Dave Millar. And Nikita Bogdanov is our research assistant.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.